First time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Chemical weapons inspectors, having arrived in Syria last week, are expected to reach the town of Douma in Syria this week to investigate a suspected chemical weapons attack April 7th that killed more than 40 people. The attack prompted an international airstrike on Saturday. A U.S. official with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons suggested Russia may have tampered with that site. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told the BBC he guarantees no tampering occurred. Russian Defense Ministry official Igor Kirillov said the nine-member LPCW team will visit Douma Wednesday. Russia is not obstructing their visit in any way. Both Moscow and Damascus deny using chemical weapons on the town. In Douma, now under government control, residents jostle for fresh bread and hope for their futures. This young man said he wants to return to his studies, perhaps become a journalist or engineer. Traveling with President Donald Trump Monday, White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Mr. Trump still wants to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria, although there is no timeline to do so.
We're still committed to defeating ISIS. We want to see that happen. The president also wants the people in the region, our Gulf partners, to step up and do more, and he wants them to take on some of the financial responsibility of all of the military provided there in the region.
She also said the president would like to have a good relationship with Russia, but it will depend on Russia's behavior. Nigerian police clashed with Shia Muslim protesters in the capital Abuja Monday. They called for the release of Islamic Movement of Nigeria leader Ibrahim Sazaki, detained since December 2015 following violent clashes with troops that left hundreds of IMN followers dead. Dozens Monday were arrested. This is VOA News. American Protestant minister has denied allegations he's linked to a group behind an attempted coup in Turkey in 2016. The lawyer for Andrew Brunson, who has served as a pastor of a Turkish church for more than 20 years, insists the charges are all about his Christian faith. Sam Brownback, U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, is in Turkey watching the case.
The administration is deeply concerned about this case. We completely believe, factually, he is innocent. Andrew Brunson is innocent. We're hopeful that the judicial system will find that he will be released and released soon.
Brunson faces up to 35 years in prison. He has been detained for 18 months. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan suggested last year his fate could be tied to that of Turkey's extradition request for exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, also accused of being behind the failed coup. The U.S. and Britain Monday accused Russia of launching cyber attacks with the aim of spying, theft of intellectual property, and other malicious activity. In February, Russia was accused of releasing the NotPetya virus that crippled parts of Ukraine's infrastructure and damaged computers elsewhere, costing billions. Moscow has denied such allegations, calling them reckless, provocative, and unfounded. Gang-related violence inside a South Carolina prison beginning late Sunday left 7 inmates dead and nearly 20 others seriously injured. Brian Sterling is the state's Corrections Department director.
What we believe from the initial investigation is that this was all about territory. This is about contraband. This is about cell phones, and you've heard us talk about these over and over again. These folks are fighting over real money and real territory while they're incarcerated.
The violence lasted hours before authorities regained control. No guards were hurt. It's believed to have been the worst prison violence in the U.S. in a quarter century. South African police Monday raided the compound of the wealthy Gupta family, part of an official investigation into allegations of theft, fraud, and money laundering in state projects. The Guptas had close political ties to former President Jacob Zuma, who was forced to resign 2 months ago over corruption allegations. The Gupta family has denied any wrongdoing. The European Union sought compensation Monday from the U.S. through the World Trade Organization for tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Brussels rejects the U.S. justification of national security for imposing those duties. U.S. stocks closed higher in Monday trading, with investors expressing growing optimism about the current earnings season. The benchmark Dow Jones gained more than 200 points to 24,573. The price of oil retreated as fears of new strikes in Syria eased, and the U.S. said retail sales in March rebounded after 3 months of straight declines. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There are more calls for dialogue between Cameroon's government and separatists.
In whichever difficult situation, dialogue cannot be suspended. Even when you have had impossible casualties, there's always room for dialogue because there is no solution without dialogue.
Joseph Banazem is the minority leader of Cameroon's parliament. South Sudan's government says Monday's protesters in Washington are all disgruntled opposition people. A court in the breakaway Republic of Somaliland has sentenced a female poet to 3 years in prison for defamation. And Zimbabwe reiterates its openness for foreign investment.
So far, the investment drive is very successful and there's tremendous interest which has been generated so far in Zimbabwe. In fact, from all over the world. Now we are in America.
Sibusiso Moyo is Zimbabwe's foreign minister. There is a new female organization to help women businesses in Guinea-Bissau and a pen that detects cancers. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The minority leader of Cameroon's parliament says the government should not reject talks with separatists in the English-speaking parts of the country. Joseph Banazem of the main opposition Social Democratic Front SDF party says dialogue is the only way to resolve the ongoing crisis in the Anglophone areas of the largely French-speaking Cameroon. His remarks came after new Interior Minister Paul Atanga Unje rejected talks with separatists, while also revealing that the government is considering issuing an ultimatum for the separatists to lay down their weapons or face the full brunt of the law. Banazem tells viewers Peter Clotty that there is no solution to any problem without dialogue.
My reaction is that it is very unfortunate because in whichever difficult situation, dialogue cannot be suspended. Even when you have had impossible casualties, when you have had impossible destructions, there's always room for dialogue because there is no solution without dialogue. So it's very unfortunate. And you would see, for instance, Mr. Peter, that in the past 1.5 years, 2 years, what could have just been brushed aside with a simple moment of dialogue has dragged on to an open war where you have killings of soldiers, of civilians, and we in the SDF are saying that it is very unfortunate that that is the situation, and we will continue to insist that there is no way out apart from dialogue.
Does that mean that the Social Democratic Front, the biggest opposition party in Cameroon, will continue with its advocacy to ensure dialogue between the government and separatist group despite the government's apparent disinterest in going along with the dialogue?
There is no way out. You are not going to eliminate them by force. They are proving to government that they are a strong force to reckon with. And government is not going to use force to eliminate them. So we think that the hardliners in government who think that force is the only way out, they are plunging this country into disarray. They want Cameroon to break into pieces like other countries have done, and I don't know what interest they will have from doing that. So we in the SDF are still of the opinion that dialogue among the citizens of this country, whoever they are, whatever they have done, and so on, you must come to the dialogue table in order to school them, educate them, and bring them over to your own position. You cannot be by force.
The government plans to offer a 30-day grace period to give the separatist element to lay down their weapons, basically a 30-day ultimatum to stop fighting. What do you make of this ultimatum by the government?
Well, then they know who the separatists are, and if they are comfortable with that, let them go ahead. All we want in Cameroon is peace and progress for our people, which is not what is happening to the two English-speaking regions of the country. They are talking of one and indivisible country. They will find one country and another small section that is being brutalized and treated like animals.
The government is saying that it has the mandate, the constitutional mandate, to protect life and property. and that what these separatists are doing is to create confusion and create disaffection in the country, and they have to use all means necessary to ensure the country's unity and indivisibility. Your take?
My take is that they've been saying that for 2 years. But where are we? It's easy to say than to do, because if it were only what government wanted, the whole thing would have been finished. But it's not as government expects. So that approach, we are convinced, is the wrong one.
Joseph Banazem is the minority leader of Cameroon's parliament. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte from Yaoundé. The South Sudan government says Monday's protest in Washington, D.C. was organized by disgruntled individuals who were fired from the government. Monday's protest was organized by the South Sudan International Advocacy for Human Rights. The group accused the government of President Salva Kiir of committing genocidal crimes and called on U.S. President Donald Trump and the international community to exert pressure on the government to stop the alleged killings. But Information Minister Michael McQuay says there is no genocide in South Sudan. He says only South Sudanese can solve their own problems, and protesting Washington, D.C. based on what he called concocted stories will not solve the country's problems.
Well, of course, what is being done by those people over there, these are the people of opposition. We know them very well. And this is not a new thing. It's a normal slogan and accusation leveled by any opposition against their government. The fact that they have gone there to mobilize the people and demonstrate, that demonstration by itself will not help, because people should not be talking on concocted stories for people who are disgruntled and they decided to go away simply because they were relieved from the government, and as such they decided to rebel and cause havoc to the people of South Sudan. I'm sure it is here in the talks that we can agree and we reach an amicable solution. But if they are demonstrating, looking for a favor from America so that they are carried to the seats of governance in South Sudan by the Americans or by the international community, I think that they are chasing a mirage.
They talk about genocidal crimes that they say are being committed by your government under President Salva Kiir. Particularly, they talk about genocide against Nuer civilians.
Is it a genocide of when? Is it that of 2013? Is it of today? Is it of when? Who do not know it, they would see it as if it is something new. But you know, reports which are written here by people in the hotels so that they seek support and so that they are funded by the community. So there is nothing new about all that is being said. There is no genocide committed in South Sudan. There is nothing as such. And if they are talking about genocide, I think it is better that they look for another country and not South Sudan.
They are calling for President Trump and the international community to put pressure on your government to stop what they call the killings and the raping of South Sudanese citizens.
There is no killing in South Sudan. And today we received the special representative or assistant secretary general for peacekeeping administration, and they are witnesses what is happening in South Sudan. So those things which have been concocted over there, these are mere stories being created for people who are living in their own world.
Minister, you said that this is the work of the opposition or the former detainees. Some of these detainees are in your government. So are you saying they are also in your government at the same time against your government?
Well, definitely. There are those here in the government and there are those who are outside. Those who are outside are the ones who are doing all this. It's just like the IO. The IO is also divided. And there's the IO in the government and there is IO in the opposition.
They say that the international community or the Trump administration should declare President Salva Kiir an illegitimate president.
It is not enough for them just to call on President Trump and they expect President Trump to react immediately because the rebels of South Sudan have so demanded. That is not possible.
Minister, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, where is your foreign minister? Is he in the country, South Sudan, or where is he?
My foreign minister is... And he has not reported so far after phase two of the revitalization forum. He has not reported back, and he seems to have joined his other colleagues over there.
Did you say the foreign minister is in Ethiopia? Where is he again?
I don't know his whereabouts. He has not come back to South Sudan.
Has your government replaced him, or would you like for him to come back home?
So now the government, His Excellency the President, has not done anything. He's giving him the opportunity to come back.
What is happening? It seems that many people are defecting from your government.
No, this is wrong. Don't say many people. How many are they? Dengalor alone is not how many. Where did you get it that so many have defected from the government? this is misquotation. The fact that Deng Alor has gone, they are already divided. They, the FDs, majority of them are in the opposition, and if he has decided to join them, that is up to him. But they have not all gone. Others are still left with us here in the transitional government of national unity.
If you said the foreign minister should come back, will he be treated fairly when he comes back?
What has he done which will lead to him being treated unfairly? What has he done?
Minister, it's always a pleasure to have you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Makui, South Sudan's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 17th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe Foreign Minister Sibusiso Moyo is trumpeting the call by President Emmerson Mnangagwa for investors to put their money in Zimbabwe, saying the country is on the right path economically and diplomatically. Moyo is currently in the United States with a delegation that includes the country's finance minister and Reserve Bank governor. Tananoka Wande of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Washington.
Zimbabwe's Foreign Minister Sibusiso Moyo, currently in New York with a high-level delegation to promote Zimbabwe as a viable country to do business, described his country as a sleeping economic giant about to surprise the world.
Zimbabwe has been a secret which has been well kept by Africa, and it is just being unveiled.
Moyo and his delegation are in New York for the Zimbabwe Investors Forum, organized by a London-based group called Exotics Capital. Last month, a group in London held a similar drive called Zimdaba, aimed at promoting Zimbabwe as a viable investment destination. The phrase, Zimbabwe is open for business, has been a consistent message by President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his administration since the resignation of longtime President Robert Mugabe last November. Moyo says the call has been received positively, both on the continent and now in the West.
So far, the investment drive is very successful, and there's tremendous interest which has been generated so far in Zimbabwe. In fact, from all over the world. Now we are in America.
Zimbabwe's strained relationship with the United States over targeted sanctions imposed in early 2000 due to allegations of election rigging and human rights violations has shown signs of easing over the past weeks, culminating in a visit by U.S. Senators Chris Coons and Jeff Flake, who recently introduced a bill to amend the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, which Zimbabwe says destroyed its economy. But Moyo says the visit by the two senators was excellent for opening up Zimbabwe to the world. The senators have demanded transparency in the upcoming elections among the preconditions for amending ZIDERA. The government says it will conduct free, credible, and fair elections in the presence of international observers.
The visit by the senators, they saw for themselves. They interacted with the rest of society. They consulted with independent personalities who gave their own views. And finally, they also interacted with us as government and with His Excellency President Mnangagwa. And they got a very clear direction which the country is taking.
Closer to home, Moyo says the demand by Zimbabweans living outside the country to vote in the elections, while not possible for the 2018 elections, could be accommodated in the future. Moyo says for the upcoming elections, which the Constitution demands must be held by August 22, it is logistically impossible for the country to accommodate the diaspora vote, so all Zimbabweans have to vote in the areas they are registered in Zimbabwe.
We are going to continue working the logistics and the modalities to ensure that our diasporans must really participate in future elections.
Reporting for VOA's Zimbabwe Service, this is Tanonoka Wande in Washington.
A court in the breakaway Republic of Somaliland has sentenced a female poet to 3 years in prison after convicting her for defamation and insulting the nation. Lawyers say the charge is related to a statement Naima Ahmed Ibrahim made while in Mogadishu last year, promoting the unity of Somalia. Somaliland says it seceded from Somalia in 1991. Separately, on Monday, the same court sentenced a social media writer, Mohammed Kese Mahamu to 18 months for offending the honor of the president of Somaliland. The charge against Mahamu relates to a Facebook posting that he made. Somaliland prosecutors defended the convictions and sentences, saying the two violated the country's constitution. Gidi Ahmed Jama is director of the only human rights center in Somaliland.
According to the charge sheet submitted by the prosecution and the judgment of the court, Naima was accused of statements she made while she was in Mogadishu. And the government argues that the statements she made are against or are a threat to the independence and suppression of Somaliland.
And what was the statement? Was it a speech? Was it a post on Facebook or social media accounts?
Initially, she was accused of both Facebook posts and statements she made in public places, including poetry. But the court said that the court convicted her of statements she made in Mogadishu. Some of them she made in Tetegas, and others she was talking to the people, and it included the poetry she made. In her statement, she didn't particularly mention Somaliland, but she talked about the unity of Somali people and the importance of unity in these kind of matters.
And what are her lawyers saying in response to the conviction and the sentence?
Her lawyers are very clear. They're arguing that the statements Naima made are those protected by the Constitution of Somaliland and the international human rights laws. In the Constitution and the international human rights laws, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, every person has a right to express opinion and to have opinion. What Naima said was only an expression of her opinion on matters that exist in here. She didn't do any act. She didn't invoke or incite violence. Therefore, for them and for us even, what she said falls under the category of freedom of expression.
And let's move on to the second case against Mohamed Kese, who was convicted for social media posts. What did he say about Somaliland that got him into trouble?
This is one of the most surprising cases I have ever seen in the years I have been working on human rights. The court said he was convicted or found guilty of offending the president of Somaliland. And what the charges related to are Facebook posts in which he said, according to the court, the president of Somaliland is a local. For the court and for the prosecution, that amount is offending the honor of the president. And that is very weird here.
And what's your reading of both cases? Does the government has a case, or do you think it's an extreme form of suppression against freedom of expression?
I believe it is a very extreme form of suppression of freedom of expression, and it's a very undemocratic move, really. Both of them have simply expressed their opinion on certain matters. In democratic sphere, in democratic system, these expressions should be respected, protected, and even promoted. Therefore, we are very concerned about this matter. The fact that both of them were initially accused of Facebook posts also raises alarm on that the fact that now the government is also basing what the people post in their Facebook accounts. And that is not what democracy is. And additionally, it is contrary to the Constitution of Somaliland, which emphasizes freedom of expression and freedom of media.
Gule Ahmed Jama is the director of the only human rights center in Somaliland. He was speaking with Harun Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. A group of about 20 female entrepreneurs in Guinea-Bissau have founded a new organization called More Young Women Entrepreneurs to help support female business leaders in the country. According to the group's co-founder, Denisa Pereira, more than 85% of formal businesses are owned by men in Guinea-Bissau. She tells Ricky Stryak more women will start businesses if given the right support and action that can help everyone in the country.
It is important for young female to know the role we are playing here, because our market is supported by females, you know, not young females, but by females. It is important for us to know that we have this power. And I think this gives us another responsible in our society, and we have to stand for it.
And what are the unique challenges that women in Guinea-Bissau face when they want to start a business? Is it more of a male-dominated society when you get to the formal economy? You know, if you talk about politics, it's mostly men running things. Is that kind of the same in the business world?
Yes, it is a challenge for us, because in every single place you go, years in our country, places are dominated by men. And some places that we should see more women, we intend to see more men, because we are not saying this is our time, this is our place. I have a role to play in my society, in our society, you know. Women are just saying like, okay, you know, the world is like this. This is Africa. Men have always the last word to say, you know. So I'm not going even to argue. And we don't have this kind of support by our fathers, brothers, and even partners. So this is a very huge challenge to men, not even only women, but men also, because they need to know. We're not here to say we are more important or we have more rights than you. No, we have this place. We can share it. We have a lot of women at the market and doing business. The thing is, they are not doing formal business.
Besides just the looking at the women empowerment issue, how do you think groups like this can improve the economy in Bissau, especially because Bissau is faced with a lot of economic issues given the government crisis at the moment?
First of all, because if you want to go far, you need to go together. Each of us, singularly, we cannot do anything. No, a group like this can be visible in our society by this kind of events we are doing and calling people that are the change makers, people that are deputies, to come join us and see what we are doing. For us, it's a challenge because the first thing we need to know to do right now is to work the mindset. Work the mindset is the first job we need to do. To say, this is not a fight. We are just trying to develop this country. And if you want to develop a country, you need to bring women together.
That was Denisa Pereira, co-founder of a new organization called More Young Entrepreneurs. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. If cancer is suspected in a patient, surgeons, in most cases, would have to cut some of the suspected tissue out and test it. Getting the results could be a long process. A new invention called MassPEC pen could cut the wait time to just seconds. VOC Elizabeth Lee reports from Austin, Texas, where the pen was created.
One touch of this pen can detect cancer almost immediately.
Well, it's a game changer because I was doing a case the other day with a surgeon and we had to wait an additional 2 hours because the current method takes that long.
Aydin Zahedivash is a medical student and co-creator of the Mass Spec pen. He says the pen can deliver cancer results within 20 seconds and is much less invasive for the patient than the traditional method of confirming the disease.
That process usually will involve taking out some of the tissue, which means cutting it from a patient. Our technology can detect cancer inside of a tissue without cutting it or altering it.
A drop of water on the pen pulls molecules from the suspected cancerous tissue during surgery. This instrument, called a mass spectrometer, then analyzes the water to determine whether cancer is present. It adds precision to detecting cancer. In seconds, surgeons will know what part of the tissue to excise, how much to cut, and what not to cut, so healthy tissue isn't damaged.
We've done testing on human tissues that have been taken out of patients, and those have shown 96% accuracy detecting cancer from not cancer.
Newly available technologies have allowed an interdisciplinary team to develop this pen in 2.5 years. Zahedivash says within the year, the mass spec pen will be tested in surgery at the Dell Medical School at the University of Texas at Austin. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Austin.
And that's it for this Tuesday, April 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.